Welcome to The Debate. Right now in Los Angeles, building a single unit of permanent supportive housing costs, well, it costs around $600,000.
Yeah, and that's on the lower end, honestly. Plus, it takes up to 6 years to actually complete.
Exactly, 6 years. Meanwhile, tonight, there are literally hundreds of thousands of empty spare bedrooms sitting completely unused in that exact same city.
Which is a pretty jarring contrast.
It really is. I mean, we have a crisis demanding immediate shelter, yet our primary policy instinct is to, you know, pour concrete and wait half a decade for a ribbon-cutting ceremony.
Right. So today, we are focusing on a 2026 concept proposal from the City of Los Angeles. It's titled Decentralized Host Home Rental Support.
And it asks a really provocative question. What if the city guaranteed rent and paid everyday homeowners to house housing-ready, unhoused individuals in their spare rooms, or their ADUs or guest houses?
And the core disagreement we're exploring today is whether this decentralized, city-guaranteed program is actually a revolutionary, scalable alternative to traditional, permanent, supportive housing.
Or, on the flip side, if it critically underestimates the massive practical, legal, and social friction of that kind of arrangement.
Right, because you are arguing that this model is mathematically sound, right?
Yes, highly pragmatic. My stance is that by shifting our focus from multi-year construction to utilizing existing residential space, we can completely bypass those massive capital bottlenecks. We can immediately house the situational and economic tier of the homeless population.
And my position is that while the math is, well, incredibly appealing on paper, the program relies on an unprecedented at-scale supply of adult host homes.
Which you see as a fatal flaw.
I see it as a critical limitation. That and its entanglement with complex, unglamorous blockers like homeowner liability, zoning laws, and tax codes, it severely limits its scalability.
Well, to really understand why a proposal like this even exists, we have to face the reality of the current pipeline. I mean, the system is quite literally collapsing under the weight of its own capital costs.
The numbers are definitely brutal.
They are. As I mentioned, right now, permanent supportive housing, or PSH, costs roughly $596,000 per unit to build. And that is just an average.
Yeah, we have seen some of those units stretch up to what, over $800,000?
Over $837,000, actually. And it takes 3 to 6 years from securing funding to getting keys and doors. When you have tens of thousands of people sleeping on the pavement, 3 to 6 years is just, it's an eternity.
It is an eternity, and the costs are undeniably staggering. But if you really want to capture the sheer fiscal weight of the current model, you have to look at the life cycle net present value.
Right, the long-term math.
Exactly. When we say life cycle net present value, we're talking about looking at the total financial burden over decades. You take that $600,000 upfront cost.
Which is already huge.
Right. Then you spread it over a 30-year lifespan at a standard 4% interest rate. And then you add in the year-over-year operating and maintenance costs. By the end of it, a single unit of permanent supportive housing actually costs the taxpayer over $1.03 million.
Wow. Over $1 million per unit?
Yeah. Nobody's defending the efficiency of the current PSH pipeline.
Exactly.
So this proposal looks at an entirely alternative math. A decentralized host home placement costs roughly $25,200 for an entire year.
And what does that cover exactly?
It includes rent capped at $1,500 a month, paid directly to the host. It also includes light touch case management, program administration, host incentives, and a damage reserve.
So for the capital cost of a single PSH unit, you get 23.7 placement years in a host home. And you can set this up in weeks, not years. Furthermore, this isn't some wild, unprecedented invention. We already see pieces of this working perfectly.
You're talking about the master leasing programs.
Right. Look at LA County's flexible housing subsidy pool. They've master leased units to house over 15,000 people since 2014. They don't just act as a referral agency.
They handle the actual leases.
Exactly. They act as the financial and administrative glue. They hold the leases, guarantee the rent to property owners, and handle the placements. We know the city-backed guarantee mechanism works.
I acknowledge the elegance of that cost stack. I really do. But there is a massive difference between master leasing an empty apartment complex and asking a family to master lease their spare bedroom.
You think the friction is just too high?
The math works beautifully if you are operating in a frictionless vacuum. But the proposal itself outlines its own honest limits. And the most glaring one is this. Host supply is the binding constraint. The math assumes the hosts actually exist.
Right. You need homeowners willing to open their doors. But why wouldn't they if the financial incentive is strong enough? I mean, $1,500 a month is significant.
Because bringing a stranger into your home isn't just a financial transaction. It's a profound psychological barrier.
But there are models for this, right?
We do have models, yes. We have youth host homes in the U.S., like Point Source Youth, operating in cities like L.A., Baltimore, and Seattle. And we have the Night Stop program in the United Kingdom.
Which has been around for decades.
Over 30 years. Yeah, with volunteer spare room hosting. But look at how Nightstop actually operates. It relies on a massive network of highly vetted community volunteers who take in young people facing immediate crises.
Right.
But, and this is crucial, those stays are usually for a few nights, maybe a couple of weeks at most. An at-scale, city-guaranteed host home program asking homeowners to sign 3 to 12 month leases with general homeless adults, that is entirely unproven in the United States.
I think you are underestimating the fiscal power behind this and the sheer scale of the potential market. Let's look at the proposal's scale scenarios.
Okay, let's hear the numbers.
If we aim for 10,000 placements, the program costs $252 million a year. That sounds like a massive number, but it is only 26.5% of LA's fiscal year 25 homeless budget.
And what kind of impact does that 26% get you?
With a 3 to 12 month lease turnover, 10,000 beds house about 16,000 people a year. That reaches 55% of the city's unsheltered population.
That is a massive chunk of the population.
It is. And if you are worried about finding the money to incentivize these hosts, the city controller recently found $513 million completely unspent in a single year. The capital is sitting right there, ready to be deployed.
But you can't just point to a pile of unspent municipal funds and say, voila, problem solved.
Why not? The money's there.
Because there's a reason that $513 million is unspent. It is tied up in bureaucratic friction, restrictive covenants, complex reporting requirements, and sheer institutional inertia. You can't just liquidize that money overnight.
Fair point. But the funding source isn't the core issue.
Right. More importantly, the constraint here isn't the city's checkbook. The constraint is human willingness. Getting to 10,000 placements requires 10,000 homeowners to look at a $1,500 monthly check and say, yes, I will invite an unknown adult into my house for a year.
Which people do all the time in other contexts.
But we are essentially asking everyday citizens to become micro-landlords of the social safety net. You're taking a massive, complex societal burden and shifting it from state-run institutions into the intimate sanctuaries of private homes.
The program does provide a safety net for the host, though.
It relies on an actuarial backstop of $1,200 for missed rent or repairs and $1,500 in host signing bonuses. Is a $1,200 repair fund really enough to overcome that deep-seated hesitation?
Well, consider this. A decade ago, critics said nobody would let a stranger sleep in their spare room. They brought up the exact same things.
You're talking about Airbnb?
Yes. They brought up liability, safety, the sanctity of the private home, the risk of property damage. And then the short-term rental market absolutely exploded. Airbnb and similar platforms normalize this behavior.
But that's a totally different market.
Why did it work, though? Because the platforms provided a financial incentive and a structural guarantee. They de-risked the market. If the city legally and financially de-risks the transaction, why wouldn't the market respond in the exact same way?
Because short-term rentals are a fundamentally different psychological and legal proposition. Hosting a tourist for a weekend while they visit Disneyland is not the same as signing a year-long lease with someone exiting homelessness.
It's still a stranger in your house.
Sure, but if you are a homeowner listening to this right now, you're probably asking the exact question that kills this kind of enthusiasm. What happens if this goes badly? How do I get them out?
And the proposal addresses that specific fear directly. It leans heavily on existing California law. Specifically, the single lodger rule, which is Civil Code Section 1946.5.
Right, the lodger law.
This is the ultimate de-risker. If an owner-occupant rents a single room in their home to a single lodger, they do not have to go through a standard eviction.
They can just terminate the agreement.
Exactly. They can end the arrangement simply by giving notice. Once that notice period expires, the lodger legally becomes a trespasser. For anyone listening who hasn't been through housing court, an unlawful detainer lawsuit isn't just a piece of paper.
It's a nightmare.
It is an exhausting, months-long court battle where you are paying legal fees while an actively hostile tenant continues to live under your roof. The single lodger rule completely bypasses that nightmare.
And what about rent control?
Assembly Bill 1482 specifically exempts these shared spaces from statewide rent caps and just cause eviction protections. The homeowner retains absolute control over their property.
Okay, yes, the single lodger rule works beautifully for a shared spare room inside the primary house. But you are ignoring the profound complexity of the two legal tracks this proposal creates.
How so?
The proposal explicitly includes studios, accessory dwelling units, and whole homes. Renting out a spare bedroom under the single lodger rule is like driving a golf cart on private property. There are very few rules, and you have total control.
Okay.
Suddenly, you are hit with massive regulations. It is a full tenancy. Standard protections apply.
Because it's a separate dwelling?
Exactly. After 12 months, just cause eviction attaches. If a fixed term lapses, it goes month to month. If a program administrator misroutes a placement or doesn't perfectly draft the exemption notice, a well-meaning volunteer suddenly wakes up as a traditional landlord, trapped in LA's notoriously difficult housing court.
But that assumes the homeowner is navigating all of this entirely alone. They aren't.
They are the ones on the deed.
True. But the program explicitly mandates that a contracted provider handles the screening, matching, and the lease structuring. The city or its nonprofit provider acts as the master leaseholder in these guarantee structures.
Which shields the homeowner?
Yes. The provider holds the lease and routes each placement down the correct legal track, completely shielding the homeowner from having to interpret AB 1482 on their own.
They might route the paperwork, but the homeowner still carries the ultimate property and financial risk. And let's talk about another one of those unglamorous blockers, taxation.
The tax implications.
Right. In the United Kingdom, they have the rent-a-room scheme. It is a massive fiscal lever that allows homeowners to earn £7,500 a year entirely tax-free by taking in a lodger. It makes hosting genuinely attractive because you keep what you earn.
And California doesn't have that.
California has absolutely no equivalent state income exclusion. So a homeowner takes in that $1,500 a month and it goes straight onto their gross income.
Right, that's $18,000 a year.
Exactly. If you are a middle-class family, that additional $18,000 a year could bump you into a higher tax bracket.
Yeah.
And suddenly that incentive shrinks significantly. It fundamentally alters the value proposition.
The proposal actually notes that a state income exclusion would be the ideal companion bill. And I agree with that. But let's look at the reality of the numbers even without a tax break.
Okay, let's look at them.
Even as taxable income, $18,000 a year in gross revenue for an empty room is a life-changing amount of money for many working-class or retired homeowners in Los Angeles.
For sure, for folks on fixed incomes.
Exactly. For an elderly homeowner living on a fixed income, that money is the difference between keeping their home and losing it. We have to compare the friction of taxation against the friction of the alternatives.
Meaning the cost of doing nothing.
Or the cost of our current interventions. You're worried about administrative friction, but we are currently spending $34,000 per recurrence on encampment sweeps.
Which is incredibly inefficient.
The data shows an encampment sweep costs roughly $34,000 and it houses absolutely no one. It is a pure recurrence cost, moving human beings from one block to the next.
I agree completely.
For $25,200, this host home program actually ends someone's homelessness for an entire year. The administrative friction of a sweep is mathematically worse than a failed host home placement.
Yeah, the sweeps are absurd.
If we look at Finland's Housing First national policy, they found that housing people before treating other needs yields roughly 15,000 euros per person per year in downstream societal savings. Fewer emergency room visits, fewer police interactions.
I am right there with you on the futility and the mathematical absurdity of encampment sweeps. But we have to be incredibly precise about who this program is actually housing, because this is not for everyone.
Absolutely. The proposal clearly states this does not solve homelessness for people with severe untreated mental illness, or profound substance use disorders. People who require 24/7 clinical support.
Right, the high acuity cases.
Those high acuity individuals still desperately need permanent supportive housing facilities with on-site staff.
Exactly. This model serves the situational and economic tier of the unhoused population, people who simply got priced out of the market. But that's where the anti-displacement guardrails mentioned in the text become so critical.
How so?
If the city steps in and guarantees $1,500 a month for an ADU or a spare room, what stops a homeowner from looking at their current market rate tenant, say someone paying $1,200?
You're worried they'll evict them?
Yes, evicting them just to capture the city's guaranteed higher rent. If this program isn't perfectly regulated, it risks inflating the very lower-end rental market it is trying to subsidize. We could end up displacing people just to house the displaced.
That is a valid fear, but we know how to solve it. We have a decade of data from the flexible housing subsidy pool on how provider networks manage these subsidies to prevent that exact scenario.
And how do they prevent it?
They don't just hand out checks blindly. They prevent market inflation by requiring a historical audit of the unit. You have to explicitly prove the room was either vacant or owner-occupied prior to program entry.
So they check the history of the space.
Right. You cannot simply swap a market tenant for a subsidized one because the eligibility criteria require documented proof of the unit's prior status.
Implementing historical audits on thousands of individual units requires immense administrative capacity, though. You are talking about deploying staff to inspect and verify thousands of distinct properties.
It takes work, yes.
And monitoring thousands of distinct leases and handling the inevitable disputes. Let's say a match breaks down at 2 a.m. on a Saturday. If that happens in a PSH facility, there's awake, on-site staff to de-escalate.
Right, which you don't have in a host home.
Exactly. In a decentralized host home, a crisis means a homeowner is calling a hotline, hoping a case manager answers the phone. The text lists match safety and exit as load-bearing pillars of the program, not optional add-ons.
Safety is paramount. Absolutely.
If the dispute resolution path isn't incredibly robust, this program collapses after the first few high-profile failures in the local news.
But the proposal acknowledges those exact operational realities and funds them. It budgets $4,800 a year for light-touch case management and another $1,800 for program administration and matching per placement.
So it's built into the cost?
Yes, it builds a cost of that administrative capacity directly into the $25,200 figure. It doesn't pretend this happens on autopilot.
But is $4,800 a year enough? That breaks down to about $400 a month for case management.
Which covers the light touch check-ins.
For a perfectly stable, housing-ready individual, perhaps that works. But homelessness is rarely a static condition. Someone who is housing ready today might experience an acute crisis tomorrow. The core vulnerability of the decentralized model is that when a crisis hits, the immediate friction is absorbed by an untrained citizen in their own living room, not a professional caseworker.
But again, this assumes the homeowner is entirely isolated. The model leverages organizational structures like SHARE, collaborative housing. They are operating right now in LA County.
SHARE is an interesting model, definitely.
They have 100 scattered site beds that house about 160 people a year through turnover. How do they do it? They pay homeowners above market rate, they meticulously match the residents, and they manage the tenant dynamics continuously.
So the homeowner isn't the primary manager.
Right. The homeowner isn't acting as a social worker. SHARE manages the relationship. The proposal simply takes that exact proven proof of concept and scales it with a municipal guarantee.
SHARE is a brilliant model, but we have to recognize that it relies on a self-selecting group of early adopters, homeowners who are deeply committed to the mission.
And you think that won't scale?
Scaling a program from 100 scattered beds to 10,000 placements requires moving from those passionate early adopters to the mass market of homeowners. And the mass market is highly risk-averse.
Well, they want guarantees.
Exactly. If you are a homeowner listening to this right now, you are probably doing the math in your head. $18,000 a year sounds great, but you're also probably wondering, what happens to my homeowner's insurance if a lodger accidentally starts a fire in the kitchen?
The insurance question is definitely a hurdle.
It's a huge hurdle. If you are running a commercial enterprise out of your home, your standard policy likely won't cover it. The proposal mentions a program hold harmless, an attempt to shield the owner, but executing a city-backed liability shield is an incredibly complex legislative lift that hasn't been tested at this scale.
It is complex, but look at the precedent. It can be done. Look at Colorado. They just passed Senate Bill 24191, which created a state-level legal framework specifically for youth host homes.
Ah, I remember that bill.
It codified stay lengths, it formalized host stipends, and most importantly, it established liability protections. It proves that the legal scaffolding can be legislated when the political will exists to do so.
So the pieces are out there.
We have pieces of this puzzle working everywhere. We have the tax incentives in the UK, the youth models in Minnesota and Baltimore, the master leasing in LA County, the liability frameworks in Colorado. The entire thesis of this proposal is that no American jurisdiction has simply assembled these proven pieces into a single cohesive engine for general adults.
But assembly is not merely putting pieces next to each other on a table. It's making them interlock under immense pressure. And that's where I maintain my caution.
From an economic standpoint, though?
From an economic standpoint, the proposal is a textbook case of Pareto efficiency, meaning we found a theoretical way to make the system cheaper and better without hurting anyone in the process.
Right.
But we don't live in a textbook. The unglamorous blockers are the reality of local governance. Zoning restrictions, liability insurance gaps, and the unpredictable nature of adult host supply mean this concept should be viewed cautiously as a supplemental pilot, not a primary systemic fix.
Well, to summarize my position, while I completely agree that robust administrative capacity, proactive historical audits, and strict anti-displacement guardrails are required, the sheer mathematical efficiency of this model cannot be ignored.
The math is definitely its strongest point.
We are talking about successfully housing a human being for the mere operating cost of a PSH unit, completely bypassing a nearly $600,000 capital cost and a multi-year construction delay.
Which is a very compelling argument.
In a crisis where every single day unhoused is a day of compounded trauma, finding a legally and fiscally plausible way to unlock existing bedrooms is an integration the city simply cannot afford to pass up.
And to summarize mine, I believe we must respect the profound friction of human behavior and property law. The math works perfectly, but only if the hosts materialize.
You need the supply.
Exactly. Until we solve the state-level tax exclusions and genuinely address those deep liability fears with rock-solid insurance guarantees, relying on volunteer homeowners to absorb the housing crisis is a fragile strategy. It is an innovative supplement, yes, but it is not the concrete foundation we ultimately need to solve systemic homelessness.
It seems we both agree that the current multi-year capital-heavy approach is entirely insufficient on its own.
Oh, 100%.
True progress is going to require us to explore these complex, multi-perspective models. We have to look at the ledger, look at the streets, and ask if we are deploying our resources with the urgency the crisis demands.
Exactly. It challenges us to look beyond the heavy machinery and the concrete and ask what we can do with what we already have.
So, we leave it to you, the listener. Think about the unused spaces in your own city. Think about how existing resources might be legally and fiscally unlocked.
It's a big question.
It is. When a crisis is flooding our streets, do we wait years to build the perfect multi-million-dollar facility? Or do we start paying people to open their doors today?